Hello, I'm Cecilia Kong with the Washington Post, and I'm so pleased to be seated next to Craig Moffett, whom I'm sure all of you have followed for quite some time. You've been following the cable and telecom industry for a couple decades plus. So very familiar with several regimes, regulatory-wise, and there is never a shortage of issues surrounding this industry, and right now there are quite a few. So thank you and welcome. Today's conference is really focused around the wireless space, but I would be remiss if I did not ask Craig his thoughts on what were the big news items over the weekend and today, which is speculation about the Comcast merger with Time Warner Cable, and your views on where the process is now and what you make of the reports that potentially the deal might be in trouble.
Well, first, thank you, and thank you for moderating this, because I think all of you are Cecilia's a better get than I am, I think. My sense is, first, I really would love to know what the source of the story was, or what the leak was, because it's rather unusual to hear from the DOJ. And to hear a sort of where the DOJ is planning to do X, Y, or Z. And so I think all of us are sort of scratching our heads about, well, how real is that position? But I think the most important part of the story was that, A, here we are 14 months in, and it was a confirmation that there have been no substantive conversations between the companies and the Department of Justice yet. And that obviously is a rather long time. And, you know, it's funny, I would hear often from my clients in the investment community that, the DOJ is not going to try to oppose this because vertical antitrust issues or monopsony issues are very novel and they haven't been tested in court over the last 30 years. And my own view all along was, look, I don't know whether it's going to be approved or rejected, but it's nonsense to suggest that, A, there aren't real antitrust issues here, and, B, that the DOJ somehow would be disinclined to try to pursue them. Then the debate shifted to, Title II gives the DOJ and the FCC the regulatory backstop that's required in order to approve the deals now, because you have some protection against the potential for anti-competitive behavior. But that comment would often come from exactly the same people who, in the next sentence, would say they believe that the Republicans or the courts would throw out Title II. So it's a really complicated landscape. Those two issues are very tightly intertwined. It's certainly above my pay grade to say that I have real insight into what the DOJ is thinking. I don't. I don't have sources. I don't know anyone who does have sources inside the DOJ who are willing to talk about what's going on in a given deal. I see the antitrust issues. They're pretty clear, and it's very hard for anybody to call whether they will be viewed as showstoppers or not.
And a couple things. Just in reading your reports over the last 14 months, it seems like you have gone from a position of saying that you believe generally this is approvable to, yes, approvable, but there's going to be much more scrutiny. And can you tell me currently what is your thinking?
Before the deal, and actually while Charter was still pursuing TWC, I said I didn't think Comcast would try it because I didn't think the deal could get approved if they did. After they submitted their proposal, we said it had a reasonably good odds of being approved, albeit with some conditions. And then as the FCC redefined broadband as 25 megabit per second product, and then as the FCC went further and went to Title II, as I said, a lot of people viewed Title II as a precondition for approving the deal. I read it the opposite. I read Title II as, look, it's very hard ideologically for the FCC to argue that we were so concerned about anti-competitive behavior that we went all the way to the so-called nuclear option of Title II to protect broadband, and then turn around and say, but now it's fine to let someone get as large as Comcast would be. So my sense was, look, each of the milestones along the way has been yet another indication that the probability of the deal being approved is going lower and lower. It doesn't mean that it's not approvable. It doesn't mean it's a foregone conclusion. But, I hate to be in this business of sounding like Jimmy the Greek putting odds on it all the time. And I constantly get asked, well, what's your latest probabilities? And I think a lot of times 50-50 is a proxy for the humility to say, I don't know. You know, and I've talked to an awful lot of antitrust attorneys, and they don't know either. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just the nature of this problem. It's a tough problem to call. There are no horizontal issues. That's not the issue. The issue is there are some very real and profound vertical issues.
Just finally, it is tough to call, though I will say that you have seen several mergers go through this process. And the last time the DOJ did reject a merger was AT&T's bid for T-Mobile. And at that point, were there indications along the way, or how did it roll out?
It followed a very similar arc in some ways, in that everyone said before that deal was proposed that an AT&T T-Mobile deal could never happen. Similar to what I had said about Comcast and TWC before it happened. And then after it was proposed, people said, well, you know, actually, maybe this does have a shot. But unlike this case, there was no warning. We all heard on a Sunday afternoon that the DOJ had decided to block it in August, and then we didn't hear from the FCC until December of 2011.
Well, let's move on to wireless. And, you know, you would think walking around, anybody who has their eyes open and see people using more data than ever, and everyone that you see the rates of adults buying smartphones and continue to increase, you would think the wireless market is really hot. And, Craig, you had a report this morning sort of laying out the state of the wireless market from an investment perspective. And would love to get your thoughts, and just if you can tell the audience about what is your view on the state of the wireless market, and why should policymakers care about that?
Well, let me, I'm going to force people to listen to a little bit of talk about accounting in a second. So forgive me for that in advance, because I know nobody wants to hear about accounting, but this may be one of those cases where it's important. But, you know, I sometimes ask audiences like this because I think it's an interesting question. I think I have an interesting purview in that I cover both the cable TV business, cable and satellite and traditional pay TV, and I also cover the wireless business and telecom. And I'd be curious to see a show of hands, because I think most people understand the pay TV business, just the video piece, not broadband, but just the video piece is sort of in secular decline. You hear about cord cutting and how that pay TV is passé. And then wireless, obviously, is a tremendous growth engine for our economy. And as you say, everybody's got wireless phones, and usage is soaring. So with that in mind, I'd be interested in seeing, just a show of hands, how many people think the wireless industry is growing revenues now? And this is the carriers, at north of 10%. Nobody. Between 5 and 10. Between 0 and 5, most of you. And then anybody negative? And for pay TV, same question. Between, let's say, between 5 and 10, 0 and 5, negative. The pay TV industry is still growing faster than the wireless business, almost twice as fast as the wireless business, actually. Now, The subscriber growth rate of wireless is now about 7%. That is, all things connected to the wireless network is growing at about 7. It dropped all the way to about 2, and now it's come back some to about 7. Most of that is tablets, but also some connected cars and things like that. But the ARPU, that is the revenue per unit, in the wireless industry is now growing at negative 7%. And so the growth rate of the wireless industry on an as-reported basis is close to 4, but there's some accounting that I want to talk about that says the underlying growth rate of wireless, apples to apples, is less than 2% now. And the growth rate of the pay TV business, where subscriber growth is 0.0, or actually about negative 1/10 of 1%, But revenue growth is still reasonably healthy and substantially faster than wireless. Most people don't think of the world that way. Most people think that wireless is a growth engine, but it's not in the U.S. In some ways, it is a very challenged industry. And I want to go through this accounting issue for a second because it's really important. All of you, I think, have heard the old model that says wireless companies subsidize phones, right? So in the old subsidy model, and again, I apologize for talking about accounting, but in the old subsidy model, you recognize the cost of the phone as soon as the customer, as soon as the transaction happens. But then the revenue from the phone is captured over the next 24 to 36 months, however long the customer keeps the device, gradually. So at the time you get the customer, there's a big negative accounting entry, and then you earn it back over time. When the industry started shifting to customers buying phones, purchase accounting is different. You still recognize the cost of the phone up front, but now you also recognize the revenue, fully recognize the revenue at the same time. Even though the customer is not actually paying for the phone up front, they're still paying you over time just like they used to. It's just now you book that as equipment revenue, and so just like any other retailer, you book the transaction up front. So it's a distinction without a difference if you're a customer, and it's really and there's really no difference whatsoever in the cash flows. But the accounting entries are completely different. In the second case, I no longer have that big negative transaction at the time of the customer sale. It's now suddenly a slightly positive transaction. So during that transition, there's a huge increase to my profitability, at least as reported. It looks like I'm growing revenues much faster, and it looks like I am, because now it's all accelerated into the present, and it looks like I'm much more profitable because I'm recognizing all of those revenues all at once. Sprint looked at that and said, I've got an even better idea, which is I'm going to call it a lease instead of a sale. And if I call it a lease, then I still get those revenues, but now the cost of the phone moves off the income statement and moves to the balance sheet. And it only comes back below the cash flow or EBITDA line, as it's called. And so it makes the phone now look like it's twice as profitable. Again, same transaction from a cash flow perspective. Ordinarily, I would never bring up accounting. But those distortions right now in the wireless industry are so profound as we make this transition that the wireless industry, again, some of you may know the term EBITDA, or earnings before interest and taxes and depreciation, amortization. It's a shorthand metric for cash flow before capital spending. That's usually the metric people look at when they say, how well is the industry doing? On an as-reported basis in the fourth quarter, it was about a negative 5%, negative 4.5%. If you stripped away the accounting changes and said what's really happening apples to apples, it was negative 20. So the industry is actually in very poor shape in terms of its profitability. Sprint, by the way, sourced 77% of its EBITDA in the fourth quarter from accounting changes. Had it not been for accounting changes, Sprint would now look like it was levered at almost 6 times. Its debt to EBITDA would be 6 times EBITDA almost. And by the end of this year, debt to EBITDA would be almost 8, which would mean Sprint would almost certainly be insolvent by the end of this year. It's a completely different picture of the economics of this business if you strip away the accounting changes and say, I really want to get to what's actually happening with the fundamentals, and not let the accounting change in the industry obscure these underlying results.
And do you believe, Craig, that the regulators and antitrust experts in Washington hold this distorted view?
Sure. I mean, it's almost certainly, unless you're a financial analyst going through all of these adjustments, your first look at the financial statements of these companies is everything looks like it's actually okay. In reality, what we're looking at is an industry that's been going through a horrific price war, good old-fashioned price war, unaffected by accounting, and it's only the accounting that is papering over the pain, and that it's actually been much, much worse from a financial perspective for the companies, not only than policymakers understand, but I think actually than most retail investors understand. Institutional investors, I think, are obviously much better equipped to be able to understand those issues, and they have the resources to be able to make those kind of adjustments.
And what do you think that this underlying financial weakness in the wireless sector, what could this portend for the industry going forward in 2015, the rest of the year, 2016, perhaps with consolidation down the pike?
It's a great question because, remember, we have two big events coming up in 2016 besides the election, one of which is the incentive auctions and the how much financial firepower these companies bring to the incentive auction is a really important question. And if the industry, all of these accounting distortions affect only the reported financials, they don't actually affect real underlying cash flows. The reality is the companies aren't generating enough cash to be able to sustain the kinds of purchases that they made in the AWS-3 auction and to try to do it again. So there is a real question about where is the money going to come from for funding these purchases? And second, if Sprint really is reaching a period where it's the cash burn rate of the company is so great that that insolvency becomes a real concern, how does that affect the ability of Sprint and T-Mobile to try again to merge in 2016? Because I think it's very likely that you will see that proposition at least back on the table. And whether it's a Republican or a Democrat administration in 2016, I think the urgency for Sprint will be sufficiently high that you will see that transaction again. And truth be told, we didn't actually see that transaction last year. It was just talked about, but it was never actually formally proposed.
You know, you talk about how this could complicate potentially the auction, the incentive auction in 2016. It's difficult to there should be so many different complicating factors, of course. And what is your thought on the fact that the last auction was so successful? Can this be a guide? It sounds like you're saying perhaps not.
It's really interesting. We just did some work to try to figure out because there's two opposing views of Spectrum, and there is a very comforting intuition that says wireless demand is rising, spectrum is scarce, ipso facto, the value of spectrum must be rising, everything else is noise. The counterargument is, okay, but spectrum is an input to a value chain, and the outputs of that value chain are shrinking rather than rising, and so any economist would tell you that the value of the inputs can't be rising over any sustainable period of time faster than the value of the outputs. So those would lead you to two diametrically opposite conclusions. One would say spectrum values are trees that grow to the sky, and the other is you better be careful about assuming that spectrum values will rise. It's really hard to figure out which of those two views is closer to right, but if you look historically at spectrum valuations, the conclusion is they are much more idiosyncratic than we would all like to think. The narrative that is really appealing is spectrum values have been on a long-term upward trajectory and they keep getting more and more valuable. That's not really true. In fact, a long-time series says spectrum, even with whatever discernible uptick you can find, have actually returned less than a corporate bond, which is to say they've been pretty low-yield types of investments. And right now the return on invested capital of the wireless industry is not very healthy. And so it's very tough to say with any certainty. Most of the empirical analysis would tell you that spectrum values are much more driven by the idiosyncrasies of the number of bidders in an auction than they are by any long-term upward trajectory in demand for spectrum. And that is a very humbling observation because it says that at any given time, one more bidder in the auction can double or triple spectrum values, one less bidder in the auction, and suddenly values collapse. And it's incredibly hard to predict that sort of thing. If we go down the path in the incentive auction of large reserve auctions and without a potential dark horse bidder like we had with Dish in the last auction, we could end up with very, very different outcomes. And it's really, really hard to predict, and we all ought to, I think, have the humility to say that sort of a trajectory through a bunch of dots is probably not going to yield the right answer.
Well, I can't have you up here and not ask you about net neutrality in Title II. I'm sure we've all talked about this quite sort of to death, but What are the investment implications for the wireless industry currently, and as this moves into court, what are you telling your investors how to think about it?
It's funny. It hasn't drawn all that large a reaction from wireless investors. It's been much bigger for wireline investors. It's something that wireline investors feared for years, ever since the 2010 flirtation with Title II under the Jenikowski administration at the FCC. And my sense is, because as most of you know, the stocks actually didn't drop very much in response to Title II, and that was a surprise to a lot of people, including me. My sense is that what we actually witnessed was a tug of war on Wall Street between portfolio managers who were very concerned about the risk of a rising dollar and therefore searched for the cable sector as a safe haven from a rising dollar, because stocks that were heavily exposed to either exports from the United States or overseas sales were going to take a hit as the dollar rose, and cable wouldn't. And so cable became a safe haven. And dollars poured into the cable sector from those portfolio managers at the same time as sector specialist analysts on the buy side were saying, whoa, be careful, Title II is a big deal. And that the portfolio managers won that tug of war temporarily. But that doesn't mean that Title II is not actually a big deal, even among the investors in the sector. And I think there is, appropriately, some very real concern from investors in the sector that that Title II will inevitably lead to price regulation, and that whether it is through the, irrespective of the assurances otherwise, that the leaving open the Section 208 complaint process and leaving open Section 201B for just and reasonable pricing almost inevitably leads to a visitation of the pricing issues by the FCC. And I think that issue, that view is widely held among wireline investors, and therefore I think you will see cable stocks continue to have some ceiling on their appreciation, even though in other ways, because of the U.S. dollar, they feel like they're the right stocks at the right time. On the wireless side, it's been much less of a concern, because I think the presumption that that with four players in the wireless market, that there will be a presumptive test of effective competition, it makes people feel a bit safer. And it's much less likely to lead to price intervention at a regulatory level, and therefore it's probably not as big a factor. Now, if Verizon decides that they want to do a wireless video business, as there's been a lot of talk that we're going to see something like that this summer, and they decide that that wireless video business is exempt from the usage caps that they charge everyone else, then it will be the first test of wireless as a managed service, offering something that consumers, I think, would certainly like, and yet is very, very close to the paid prioritization problem that the FCC was trying to solve in the first place. And I wouldn't pretend that I can predict how it will come out, except for saying I can say with a great deal of certainty that it would be very controversial and would generate an awful lot of noise. And who knows where it would be resolved, but that it could be a very important watershed moment that we see as early as this summer.
Interesting. Well, finally, I know we're running out of time. What are some of the most important regulatory issues that could affect the wireless industry for the rest of the year going into 2016 that we haven't covered yet that you think that this audience should know about?
Well, I think we talked about the two of them already. I think the two biggest ones are three, I guess. The first one is the incentive auction in 2016, assuming it happens in 2016, because, as I said, you saw this huge increase in the input costs for spectrum in the AWS-3 auction at the same time as the output of the industry is actually falling in economic terms. That's not sustainable. It's a real problem. Second thing is whether or not we see an appetite for consolidation, because I do think that this narrative about four is unsustainable. Whether that turns out to be true or not, sprint is probably unsustainable, and so that is a genuine policy problem. It may be, by the way, that policymakers decide I don't care if sprint becomes insolvent because it would simply, even if they declared bankruptcy, they would simply wash the balance sheet clean. They would come out, and consumers wouldn't actually be all that badly affected. It's not the FCC's or any policymaker's job to protect equity holders and bondholders. It's the FCC's and a policymaker's job to protect consumers. But it certainly is a consideration. And then the third is this net neutrality question, which is what happens with these kind of zero-rated services or paid prioritization services, and what does that mean for the future of video delivery over wireless? Video delivery over wireless and the idea that we're all going to be watching video over our wireless devices when we're not connected to Wi-Fi really depends on it's a pricing question, right? Is how expensive is it going to be to do that? And if on the one hand, for policy reasons, we decide we can't really allow that to be treated differently if it is proprietary to Verizon than if it's coming from YouTube or Netflix or someone else, then we come up with a very different answer than if you say no, it's okay to create these kind of zero-rated services, and that's going to be tested relatively soon.
Thank you so much, Craig. We covered a lot, and we didn't even have time for questions, but he'll be around. And thank you for listening. Thank you for being here.
Great. Thank you.